Hi, welcome to the Conservative Social Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Robert Mather. You can also see my archive podcasts at www.theconservativesocialpsychologist.com. Today we're going to talk about attitudes and persuasion. We're calling this Persuasion 101. So an attitude is an evaluation of a person, object, or an idea. There are really three components to the attitude. An attitude can have an affective component or an emotional component. It can have a behavioral component, where you observe behaviors or actions, and a cognitive component, where we're talking about thoughts and beliefs. And so that's really the ABC model, affective, behavioral, cognition, or the tripartite model of attitudes. There's evidence that identical twins share attitudes more than fraternal twins, even when they're raised apart and they don't know each other. Now, this is not that a political attitude is inherited in any way or something like that. It's really based likely on the inherited components of personality. And so personality is something that's inherited, and that can lead you to have similar likes and dislikes and similar experiences that then shape some of those other attitudes. There's a difference between explicit attitudes and implicit attitudes. So explicit attitudes are ones that we can self-report. So if I ask you, what is your attitude towards a particular candidate, negative or positive, you can tell me that. Implicit attitude is one that you're less aware of. You can become aware of it, but it's involuntary, uncontrollable, unconscious is kind of the basis of that attitude. A good example of that was a graduate student that I had one time in class, in my graduate class. And we were talking about the implicit associations test, or the IAT, and it measures response times towards different things and can give you an indicator of particular biases. Well, he had been a very strong supporter of Al Gore in the 2004 election, but when he took the Bush-Gore IAT, it showed that he had a more positive preference for George Bush. He couldn't understand that, and that didn't predict his voting behavior or anything about what his explicit behaviors were or what he was going to do. But what I told him was that means that the Bush campaign had done a much better job of pairing Bush and making a positive association with their candidate than the Gore campaign had done. When we talk about persuasion, we're talking about the process of changing attitudes. And one of the biggest models of persuasion is the elaboration likelihood model of persuasion. And so in the elaboration likelihood model of persuasion, there's two routes to persuasion. The first route is the central route. This is where you think carefully about something. You're thinking careful about a message. You're influenced by the strength and the quality of the argument. So strong, high-quality arguments, that's what it takes to persuade somebody who's in the central route of persuasion. The peripheral route of persuasion, those people are influenced by what we'd say kind of the more superficial cues, the attractiveness of the messenger, things like that, the shiny bells and whistles. They're thinking less about it, and they're more easily influenced by those superficial cues. Now, to kind of sum up some of the larger scale attitude and persuasion research, we talk about some of the research of Carl Hovland, Irving Janis, and Harold Kelly. And so they were social psychologists that had gotten drafted into working for the U.S. Army during World War II and using their attitude and persuasion skills to help the U.S. Army develop propaganda, wartime propaganda. And once they got out of that, then they went back to using their particular research skills, but they worked at Ivy League schools to do that. And so they developed what's called the Yale Attitude Change Approach, which is really who says what to whom. And so the who component is the source of the message, the what component is the message, and then the to whom part is the audience. And so let's take a look at the source, right? The who and the who says what to whom. And so sources that are viewed as being credible are more persuasive than those that are less credible. And then what components make up credibility? Two of the biggest predictors of being seen as credible are competence and trustworthiness. So if you rate somebody as being more trustworthy and more competent, they're going to be viewed as more credible and they're going to be more persuasive. You're in a time of, in this particular time right now when I'm doing this podcast, we're looking facing the coronavirus epidemic, and the doctor would be considered more of a competent, trustworthy, credible source than perhaps one of your distant cousins that you barely know that's trying to give you advice on Facebook. Also, other components of the source that make them more persuasive, being likable. And who do we see as being likable? We see likable people as being similar to us and being attractive. as far as components of the message go, which is the what and the who says what to whom. Messages that don't appear to attempt persuasion are more persuasive. When they appear to attempt persuasion, that raises what we call counter-arguments. And so we come up with reasons why we try to pick apart that argument, which engages our critical thinking, and that's a good thing. But we're more likely to attack a message that we believe is trying to persuade us than one that's kind of flying under the radar of those counter-arguments. Messages shouldn't be extreme, kind of similar to that. Extreme messages engage our counter-arguments or can frighten us, depending on the type of message. So messages that are more extreme are less persuasive. Messages that are less extreme fly under the radar of those counter-arguments. If an audience is highly involved, they're really paying attention to the message, is trying to persuade them of something that really does affect them and they know that, the central route of persuasion is the way to attack the message. An audience that's low in involvement, you'd want to use the peripheral route. So they're less engaged. They don't really care about the message or what the implications of it are. The bells and whistles are easier to persuade them. Fear can work as a message if it's not too extreme, because if it's too extreme, it'll turn people off. If you see that hideous billboard when you're driving down the road, you don't look at it and you don't read the message. Same thing with a commercial. If I see this commercial that's extremely frightening, I'm just going to change the channel. Fear can also work as a message, first we said, if it's not too extreme, but if it provides specific instructions on how to avoid that danger. So if it tells you, if this happens, do this, or this is going to happen, do this. An example of a fear-based message would be President Johnson's 1964, what's called the Daisy ad. And so it was a little girl picking flowers, and then there's a nuclear explosion, and you hear, "Vote for Johnson." That was an example of a fear-based message. It only aired one time. It aired late at night. They deemed it too scary for people, and so it really wasn't seen much. But if you go to YouTube and look up the LBJ Daisy commercial or 1964 Daisy commercial, you'll see that. In that same election, Goldwater had kind of a similar message, which was your children will become communists if you vote for Lyndon Johnson. And so those are two interesting kind of fear-based messages that you may want to look up at some point. The third part of all of this, we had the who says what to whom, is the whom part, the audience. And so people in a good mood think less about a message and are easier to persuade. You just use the peripheral route for that. There are individual characteristics of people. There's a characteristic called need for cognition, which is how much people enjoy and engage in effortful thinking, how much they like to think. That's different than intelligence. If you think about it, you can think of high intelligent people that don't like to think. That can be frustrating. It seems like a waste of talent. You can think of low intelligence people who really do like to think, and they're really frustrating to talk to because they just don't understand arguments, but they really want to and try to analyze them. And of course, anything in between. So it really is independent of intellect. But need for cognition is how much you enjoy and engage in effortful thinking. People that are high need for cognition, it's simple. You use the central route to persuade them because they're paying attention most of the time and critically analyzing most of the time. Low need for cognition people use the peripheral route, use bells and whistles to try to persuade them. Self-monitoring, which is how much people change their behavior across situations. You know, if I'm paying attention to how I come off in this situation versus this situation, then I'd be a high self-monitor. A low self-monitor is somebody who doesn't do that much. Most people fall kind of in between. People who are high self-monitors are influenced by having a desirable social image. So if this thing could make me cool, if I'm a high self-monitor, then I'm more likely to engage in the behavior that will lead to that. Distraction makes it easier to persuade an audience. If you distract them, then you just use the peripheral route to persuasion. People of low intelligence are easier to persuade than people who are of higher intelligence. For low intelligence people, use the peripheral route to persuasion. People who have moderate self-esteem are easier to persuade than people who have low or high self-esteem. If you've got low or high self-esteem, then you're more entrenched in your attitude towards yourself. That's what self-esteem is. Do I like or dislike myself and how much? And so somebody who's low or high in self-esteem, they know how they feel about themselves. And so any information that they're getting for an attitude is going to have to fit with that. People with moderate self-esteem are easier to persuade. People are most susceptible to attitude change when they're between the ages of 18 and 25 years old. Attitudes beyond that are much more stable and resistant to change. The years in our culture between 18 and 25, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of new experiences people are encountering in their life development. And they tend to solidify their attitudes after that on most issues. So here the question is, why wouldn't you just try to distract people all the time and use the peripheral route to persuasion if that's the really kind of the easier way to do it? Well, the reason is that because persuasion based on the central route, which is the high thinking route, creates long-lasting attitude change that's more resistant to counter-persuasion than the peripheral route. So the peripheral route-based attitude change, if you change somebody's mind based on that, then someone else is just going to come along and change their mind right after that. So if you want to create long-lasting attitude change, then you want to engage your audience and get them thinking critically, and then you want to give them a central root message that they can understand and comprehend. And so those are some of the basic elements of persuasion. And if you're interested in more things, check out my website, theconservativesocialpsychologist.com. And thank you very much. I'm Dr. Robert Mather.